This podcast is sponsored by Sophie Reaptress, a one-person business based out of Philadelphia. She started making leggings a while back, and she's expanded from there over the years. When she started making caving suits, she was looking for caving suits, and she didn't notice a whole lot to choose from, so she started to make her own. And the cave suits that she makes are made from 500 denier cordura and 1,000 denier cordura, where you need a little reinforcement. You know what I mean? Like elbows and knees and booties. There's a lot of colors to choose from. If you go to her website, which I've got posted in the description of this podcast, you'll see lots of choices. And they start from basic suits, and you can have add-ons. These are custom suits. You can choose extra pockets, inside pockets, knee pad pockets, extra bat stencils. She puts bat stencils on them. They look really, really great. And everything, like I said, is made to order just for you. And her website is sophiereaptress.com. But yeah, if you've been looking for a custom caving suit and you want to help out a small caver-owned business, and all caver-owned businesses are small, let's be real, visit the website, place an order, or ask some questions. SophieReaptress.com. And again, the link is posted in the description of this podcast. Thank you, Sophie. And welcome to the Caving Podcast. My name is Matt Pelser. I'm a member of the Central Indiana Grotto, former chairman. What's a grotto? Caving club is basically what it is. Caving club. Here in the United States, we call them grottos. They're local chapters of the National Speleological Society. And if you're interested in caving, a grotto is the first place to start. Now, you don't have to become a member right away. You can just email the leadership, or if you can find other members of said grotto and ask them to take you on a trip. More often than not, they'd be more than happy to take you. Because caving's like a lot of things. It can be dangerous if you don't know what you're doing. But quite the opposite if you do, and the only way you learn is by going with people who do know. And we got a lot of rules, which are there for your safety. I could go through them right now, but suffice to say, the best thing to do is just to get involved with your local grotto, or at least get to know a few people. And then if you find that you really like caving, join the grotto, join the NSS. And I've got another link in the description of this podcast that will help you do that at the NSS website, caves.org. That's pretty easy to remember, right? Caves.org. Oh, let's see. Oh, God. Indiana Cave Capers. What a great weekend. Attendance is building for Indiana Cave Capers, and we have met the demand. And even though we've been doing it for decades now, I mean, this was the 69th annual Cave Capers, it just gets better and better every year. The Friday night jam was so good. The live music on Saturday night was so good. I went on a lot of great caving trips. My gosh, we had a ropes course out there. Congrats and thank you to everyone who came to Indiana Cave Capers and set up the rope course. It was really a world-class course. I wish I would have gotten to do it, but I saw a lot of people doing it and I was really, really impressed. I mean, they were up practically all night, Friday night, setting the thing up, and people were all over it on Saturday and Sunday. Really, really cool. And I got to go caving with Thomas Hawkins, a former guest on this podcast. I didn't know he was going to be there, and I didn't know I'd get to go caving with him, but I kind of kept my options open. I got there in kind of the middle of the afternoon on Friday and had a few people ask me what I was going to do, and I don't know. I'm trying to figure it out. I had a few people offer me a spot on their trip, and I appreciated that, but there were a few things that I wanted to do, and there were a few things that I didn't really want to do, and so I was like, I'm going to see what happens, and it got to be Saturday morning and I didn't have any plans yet, and I'm cooking breakfast and Rand Hazlett, who hasn't been on the podcast, but I'm going to get him, comes driving by in his truck, says good morning. I said, what are you doing today? He's like, I don't know. I don't have any plans. I said, me either. You want to do something? He said, sure. So we went to Gory Hole, which is Indiana's deepest pit at about 142 feet or 137 feet, depending on who you ask. And I was getting my gear together. And he comes by again in his truck and he says, I picked up a straggler. And it was Thomas. And the three of us went to Gory Hole and it was just so wonderful. I had seen Thomas the day before. It was a surprise that he was there. And we talked and talked and talked. Oh, and I met up with Carol Vesely. I didn't know she was going to be there all the way from California too. They drove all the way from California. So I got to meet Carol Vesely in person, the woman who discovered Cheve. I mean, come on. I was absolutely, as I am anytime I do this podcast, I was starstruck. Starstruck in the caving world, man. And so Rand and Thomas and I went to Gory Hole. I got attacked by fire ants on the way there. I was walking to the cave and my foot starts stinging. I'm like, oh, man, I must have, you know, walk through a bramble or something. And it keeps stinging. And I'm like reaching down and I'm scratching. I get to the cave and I'm like, what is going on? I take my shoe off. Two or three fire ants in there. I must have stepped on a hill. I don't know. It just added to the adventure. It was a lot of fun. Had a great banquet that night. Another former guest on the podcast, Holly McClintock, did her presentation at the banquet on the exploration that she's done in Roppel Cave. That was super cool. And then after the banquet, I met a couple guys from West Virginia, Brady Zimmerman, Maxwell Turnwald, and they said they were fans of the podcast. I said, oh, right on. Cool. Well, thank you. Great to meet you. And then I saw him again at the party afterward. And I said, you guys want to go caving tomorrow? Because I didn't have anything planned for Sunday. And they were like, yeah, sure. Yeah, let's go. And so we made plans to go to Buckner. You know about Buckner. I talk about Buckner all the time, probably too much. And the next morning we met up and we went. And I had the best trip that I've ever had in that cave. Hands down, full stop. Best Buckner trip ever, because usually I'm taking people who it's like their first time or they don't go caving that much. And so they're not up for as much as, you know, real cavers are. But these guys were real cavers. And so we went counterclockwise around the circle route. Not what I usually do. Popped up into the volcano room, went all through there, kept going around the circle route, got to the Air Force room. And if you don't know this cave, my apologies, but there's an alternate route around the circle route from the Air Force room back out into the big room called Keen's Grotto. And I'd never done that. I'd been down there through the canyon, but I'd never gone through. And there are these low dirt crawls that you got to get through. And I'd looked down in there. I'd crawled in there a little ways, but I'd never gone through. And we went through. And I'm so glad to have done that. And then we went and did another part called Gurgle Spring, which is this kind of lower level crawl that goes through, but the last few feet are super tight. And I tried so hard. I tried so hard to make it through and I just couldn't do it. I might have been able to do it and I'm sure I'll go back and stupidly try to do it again, but I just couldn't get over this rock with my back on the ceiling. And I would have wigged out. I don't know, man. So I backed out, went back out the other way, and then they did it. They stayed and they went through and I met them on the other side. And then we did the waterfall passage. I mean, we did it all. We didn't do it all, but we did more than I've ever done in there in a single trip. So thank you, Brady and Max. Can I call you Max? Maxwell, for that. So it was a great Indiana Cave Capers. I hope you come next year. All right. Please make plans to come next year. We usually do it in early August. Thank you to the Out of Bounds Grotto. Had a great grotto presentation this past month with them. They're a virtual grotto. If you want to think about membership, you can search Out of Bounds Grotto. And if you enjoy this podcast, think about maybe checking out the other podcasts that I do through my job. I'm a radio personality in Indianapolis, and we have a podcast called WTTS In Conversation, where I interview rock stars, essentially. And it's super cool, but I can tell you this, and this is kind of funny. This podcast, the Caving Podcast, sadly, gets more listeners than that one. And so we could use a little help over there. And they're just quick little 15, 20-minute interviews with musicians. And so if you like the way I do interviews, then check out what I do in my professional life. Again, that one's called WTTS In Conversation. Subscribe, listen. It's a lot of fun. Okay, so I got to get to this month's guest. I have been trying to get Marian Akers for, I want to say, a couple of years now. And she always said she would do it, but was always kind of hesitant. And I totally get why, you know? For one thing, most cavers that I talk to are not done caving, you know, so their story is not finished. But also, you know, it's intimidating to be on record, you know, especially in a world that can be so secretive and dynamic and sensitive like caving, you know? So I totally understand that. But she finally said, I think I'm ready. I think I'm ready and I want to do it in person, which is great. I haven't had anybody in the big chair in literally years. COVID, any number of reasons. So she came to the house one afternoon and we sat down for more than 2 hours. So this is going to be a two-parter. And we're actually not done. She wants to schedule some more time this coming month to tell a couple more stories. So I can't wait to hear them, and I can't wait for you to hear them next month. But for now, let's enjoy part one of Marian Akers, and she references another past guest, Pat Cambyses, and she talks about her husband, Tony Akers, an awful lot, who did a short little thing with me on my Indiana Cave Capers episode that I did last year, if you want to go back and check that one out. But anyway, Marian and I had some great moments at Capers as well, and that was after we had recorded this interview already. And Marian, you're just the greatest, and you're about to hear as much. So here is part one of my great talk with Marian Akers. Marian, I am having a hard time believing that you started in 1993, and I don't know why, but I just have this image of you having been caving for longer than that for some reason. I don't know why, even though that was 29 years ago.
Yeah. Well, I've always been an outdoor person.
Yeah.
So before that, I was hiking a lot, camping, backpacking, mountain biking. I didn't even know about caving.
But you knew there were caves, but it was, okay, so the first cave was a lot of people's first cave.
Yeah.
Petty John's Cave.
Yeah, yeah. So we were up, you know, in the Pigeon Mountain area, and I think we had done a mountain bike trip, and we were in this parking lot. We saw this group of cavers, which we didn't even know what they were, you know, come out of the woods, out of this little trail, covered in mud, you know, coveralls on, and they're laughing and
what were you
hollering,
guys doing?
And we're just looking at them going, who are these people? What are they doing? You know, but they're, God, they look like they're having fun. You know, what is this? So we didn't say anything to them, but after they left, we walked down that little trail, and it's not that far off the road, and we looked down in what we later learned was Petty John's Cave, and it's just this little nondescript hole, you know, not real big, and, you know, but we were both really intrigued. It was John and I, John Swartz and I, so we went to REI and got a book on caving.
Okay. They had a book on caving?
Yeah, they had a book on caving. So, like, we got, like, the basics. You know, I think we got a helmet and a light, you know, and elbow pads and knee pads and gloves. And I, you know, we went back to Petty John's. And we went in there, just the two of us.
This was the first trip?
Yeah. Yeah, we didn't have any idea what we were doing. We went in there. I don't think we got but a couple hundred feet. Because
you realize pretty quick if that's the way you're starting. Oh, wait a minute. If you got half a brain, you're like, I don't know if we're in our element here.
Yeah. Well, because it's not like a straightforward one passage, let's go kind of cave. It's mazy. It's full of breakdown. Mm. There's multiple ways you can go. You know, it's muddy. So after that, we were just like, well, what, you know, what is this? You know, we need to learn about this. And we really didn't, grottos really didn't come on our radar at that point. So we just started going back up to Pigeon Mountain area and camping.
Okay.
And we just met locals. We met local cavers, not Project or NSS cavers. We met some local people, real nice. And they basically were just, they weren't really flashlight cavers, but they were just hard hats. You know, and they would just run around camp every weekend and do a bunch of horizontal caves.
Yeah.
So that's how we started. And then pretty soon we started meeting more people. And I started realizing that, you know, there's so many vertical caves around. If I wanted to do any vertical, if I wanted to get into those caves, I would have to learn vertical.
So those people were talking about vertical and the fact that you can, you know, do that and do the rope stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And they didn't really do that.
They didn't do it, but they knew about it.
They knew about it.
Okay.
And then we started to hear more about caves. And then we started to meet more people. And coincidentally, we met Dave Quillen, who turned out lived in our neighborhood, the same neighborhood, just down the street. And he was a vertical caver.
Yeah.
I'd say he loved vertical. Him and his friends would go do pits, listen to heavy metal music. And, you know, they were, you know, a little more on the crazy side, but great cavers. And so Dave is who taught us how to do vertical, got us set up. And I started using, and he used the frog system. So I went straight to frog. I did use the rope walker a little bit, but.
What do you use now?
Frog.
You're still on the frog.
Yeah. I mean, the rope walker is easier, of course, but it's got all these little pulleys.
Yeah.
And if you want to do multi-drop vertical caves, it's just not really
keep it simple.
Yeah. It's a lot better to get up and over lips and do, you know, do rebelays and things like that.
When you were first getting into it with those local cavers, obviously, there was something that brought you back. I mean, did you just from the word go think it was the coolest thing, even though you weren't as prepared as you wanted to be the first time?
I'd say caving. I took to caving like instantly.
Yeah,
I really did. And
that's great.
Loved it, whether I was crawling or like the vertical. I liked the vertical, but I really liked being in the cave.
Yeah.
So I think it actually made me stronger.
So vertical, you get into vertical thanks to Dave.
Thanks to Dave. Got into vertical. I think my very first pit was Gord Neck, which is a little multi-drop cave.
Did you do several of the drops or did you just do the first drop? I mean, it was your first one.
I think I did the whole cave, but the first drop was like a 30-footer or something. And
okay.
It's partly wet in there. But yeah, within, you know, I did the Ellison's warm-up pit.
Within that year,
it was like 150 foot, I think. Something like that. But then at that point, we were starting to meet real other cavers that were doing project work. I met J.V. Swearingen, Chris and Julie Hudson. And, you know, in about 3 years, I'd done about 100 different caves.
Wow.
And it was kind of cool because I kept this little index card box, and I would write down everything, which I look back on now. I didn't do that my whole caving career, unfortunately, but so that's neat to look back on because I can really look and see what I did. And with Dave, you know, it was Dave, John, and I who were doing lots of stuff initially, lots of different vertical caves, mostly multi-drops. But yeah, within a couple years, I'd, you know, done some of Ellison's, Fern, Blue Spring Cave, McBride's, Paint Rock River Cave, which is pretty amazing, multi-drop.
Had you joined a grotto in those 3 years at that point?
Not really.
But you were talking to real cavers involved with grottos and things.
Yeah, and at that point I was helping JV with his photography trips. Of course, he liked to photograph girls in caves.
I've heard about that.
Yeah. And I modeled a couple times for him and had my prom dress on and then he'll like tight heaven. And I didn't mind. It was fun. You know, some people might mind that now, but JV is just such a wonderful person. I mean, he's the kind of guy that you could stay up and talk to all night long, you know, and he just had this loud laugh, you know, and he's just so fun, you know. And so I was caving almost every weekend.
Well, I guess so. If you did 100 caves in 3 years, you might as well.
Yeah, I was.
Wow.
I wanted to mention one particular trip that we went to. You know, I've kind of had this thing where I've always wanted to write an article because I've almost, you know, I've narrow disasters with water like 3 times in my life.
Is this Thunder Hole?
Thunder Hole's the second time.
Oh.
Second time. The first time was actually not in a cave, but on a trail.
Ah, what?
So I was in college, and I'll tell you about this briefly, and one of my favorite places in the world is still Joyce Kilmer, Citico Creek Wilderness Area.
Hmm.
You ever heard of that?
No.
Like southwest of the Smoky Mountains.
Okay.
So that same area. I was going hiking with a friend of mine, you know, and we were still pretty raw. You know, we had big, heavy packs. And we crossed this creek called Slick Rock Creek.
Should have been an indicator.
Yeah. And it was, you know, maybe, you know, up to our knees or something. Nothing big. Easy to cross. So we crossed that, and like for the next 2 days, it kind of rained. Not like pouring, but continuous rain.
But you're out in it, and
we're
it's just raining.
We're out in it, we're hiking, and we move into the Citico Creek area, which they're two different names because it covers two different states, Tennessee and North Carolina. So we go into the Citico Creek wilderness, and it's not as well marked. we kind of get ourselves a little bit lost and turned around, and we ended up just kind of like camping like in the middle of a trail, you know, because we couldn't find a campsite.
Who hasn't been there?
Yeah. And so by the morning we wake up, you know, there's like a river in our tent. You know, everything is soaked to the core, sleeping bags, everything is soaked. So we're like, you know, maybe we should just, you know, try and head back, find the trail back and just get out of here because we're, you know, this is getting too much and we're totally wet. Everything's wet. So we get back, we find our way back and we get back to that junction and it's still kind of drizzly rainy and it's a raging torrent. It's not that wide. I mean, I don't remember it being, you know, more than 20 feet wide, really, but it is raging. We were like, well, we got to, you know, try and get across this thing. So Rob starts across, and he's tall. He's like almost 7 feet tall.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right.
He's really tall. So, you know, he's holding my hand, and he starts crossing. It's not very far into it. He's up to his thighs. So, you know, someone that tall, once I get to that spot, I'm at my waist and I get my feet come out and I get swept, you know, away kind of underwater. I'm underwater.
Well, he's still holding on?
Well, he's, you know, he grabs on to the outside of my backpack, you know, which I had an external frame at that point.
Yeah.
So he grabs onto that top of the external frame, kind of drags me back over to where we had started, where we tried to cross. You know, at that point, we're looking at it, you know, I'm wet again to the core, you know, and we knew we couldn't really cross. So we just, you know, set up. We, like, found a place to set up. We didn't even set up a tent because it was – we just kind of made
What's the point?
Made a lean-to.
Yeah.
And, you know – draped everything over, got in our wet bags, and just started eating. We're just going to eat our food.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, I always have a lot of food.
You need comfort.
So, yeah, we just started eating, and we just hung out and laid there all day. And then the next day, we again couldn't cross, but we hiked kind of up the creek bed and found a way to cross and got out of there. So that's a big distinct memory for me that you know.
That sounds like a miserable trip.
It's great wilderness, though.
Oh, yeah,
it's
I bet it is.
Yeah, it's still a wonderful place. And I've gone back to that spot and been like, well, this just doesn't look familiar, you know, but it was that.
Well, it looked a little different at
the
time.
Yeah, yeah, it did. So that was the one time. So Thunderhole, it's a wet multi-drop. Five or six drops, they're all basically wet. So you're, you know, rappelling, you're getting wet, you're in water. So we had thick wetsuits. So I had a thick wetsuit on, and I'm pretty sure I had Farmer John and...
Oh, wow, you doubled up?
So I had, you know, because it was, you know, I just thought, well, we all had wetsuits. And I just remember it being heavy and thick. Because it was so heavy and thick, my gear didn't fit.
Mm.
So I loosened it. And I didn't really realize, you know, what that meant at the time. So we, you know, rappel down and...
But if it's tight enough with the wetsuits on, I mean, you're okay, though. Okay, I'll let you keep going.
Well, yeah, if you keep certain parts of it tight enough...
But, okay.
So what happened, you know, so like I'm at the bottom... We all go up the first drop, and I just remember just, like, being totally worn out. Like, God, this thing's only, like, 40 feet, and, God, I just barely got up. I was exhausted, and I didn't know why. Didn't understand why. So you get to the second drop, and they went up ahead of me, both of them, John and Dave, and I go up, and I'm about halfway up, and I can't go any further. And I was struggling and struggling, and pretty soon my crawl was locked into the rope. Oh. And I couldn't have changed over if I wanted to.
And you're in water.
And I'm in water, hanging in water.
Cold water?
Well, yeah,
cold water,
pummeling, you know. And they're hollering down at me, and, you know, I'm just going, I can't move. You know, I can't go anywhere. You know, I can't change over. My crawl was locked in the rope.
How'd that happen?
Because I struggled so much to try and move that it bit into the rope.
And it just wasn't going to.
Oh, it wasn't even going to move. So they ended up rigging another rope. And John came down to me and lifted me up, and I managed to get past that.
Mm.
And, I mean, I about bit the rope in two. And we took that little piece home and laid it on the counter for a while. You know, I'd pretty much bit into the sheath.
Really?
It was almost ripped in two.
Wow.
And it was because we figured out it's because I loosened my gear enough that, you know, I was hanging back on rope. So I wasn't up against the rope. Like a normal frog, you know, you're really, everything's really tight and your chest harness, everything's cinched down to where you're scrunched over.
Yeah.
And that keeps you up on the rope. So if you're hanging back in any way, you're less efficient. You have to take a lot more energy to move. And it must have been that much out of sync that, you know, it took so much energy for me to move that, you know. So we got out of there okay.
Do you know about how long you were in that compromised position?
I would say at least 30 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah. God. Yeah. So that was kind of a pretty much an eye-opener, like, you know, to be hanging in water. And
did that change anything moving forward? Like after that, did you not do a whole lot of vertical for a little bit?
No, nothing's going to stop you. I don't think it really stopped me, but I was really much more aware of my gear. And I don't think I ever wore a wetsuit that thick again, you know, and we realized, you know, what had caused that. So that was kind of a big event. So I was like, well, that's my second time I've almost, you know, died in water.
We'll get to the third one later.
Yeah. You know about that one.
I do. It's been discussed. Now, then you get into project caving, or had you been in project caving a little bit by this point?
I mean, I think I had met some people and I'd done some trips and done a little bit of survey and learned, you know, done some photo trips. But Dave, John and I were mostly just visiting caves and having fun.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, going every weekend and camping. I think even Angela Morgan come on our group. But then I think I started branching out more. Both John and I started sketching. And then I met Pat. I'm not exactly sure which cave I met her at.
Pat Kambisis,
I was trying to figure out what cave that was. But she saw that, you know, I really liked caving and would do anything. Like, I loved crawling, you know, which is kind of rare.
Yeah.
And so she started teaching me how to survey. So I think a pivotal trip was, and this is a trip I met Tony at too, was a cave called MOS Well. It was also called Obscure Magnificence.
What's with the dual names?
I don't know. I don't know how that happened. MOS was involved in this discovery, I'm thinking.
Yeah.
But there are dual names here. You might have to ask Pat that again.
I've just heard dual names for other caves too, and there's a story there, you know?
Yeah, there is. I didn't know the story. I was still pretty fresh. And but Pat was like, she was like, well, she goes, a couple caves I've done that I've called up the Indiana boys and they come and rig it for me and they're explorers.
Yeah.
So they like to push the bottom, see if there's more cave. And then I follow with my survey team. And she goes, they're really good at it. And they're really all very nice and, you know, good cavers, strong cavers.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, okay, you know, that sounds good. So they intrigued me from the start.
Yeah.
So they come rolling in Friday night, you know, really late, driving all hours, you know. And then the morning they get up and they cook this big, huge breakfast, you know, hash browns, bacon, you know, the whole works. I'm thinking, who are these guys? You know, this is kind of unusual. So the whole trip, they're ahead of us. And I'm surveying, and I'm helping Pat survey.
Okay.
Okay. And
so you're just entering, like, you know.
Well, I'm using an instrument. I'm using a Sunto.
Okay.
Okay, so I was pretty fresh, really. She took me in this pretty serious cave, but I was pretty fresh still to survey.
You got to start somewhere.
So I'm giving her readings and stuff, and we're probably a couple drops down and in the cave. And I give her this reading, and she's like, well, that can't be. And I give her an inclination reading.
Yeah.
She goes, well, that's, you know, that's above 90 or that can't be. I was like, I give her a really big number. And she goes, what side of the instrument are you reading?
Uh-oh.
And I told her, and she goes, and it was the wrong side. So it was like one side is the angle, another side is a percentage.
Did you have to start over?
Well, she goes, have you been doing that the whole time?
Oh, no.
So I was kind of mortified, you know. I was like,
yes,
I think so. You know, I think I have. And so that was kind of crazy, you know. But she handled it, you know, was nice, handled it with grace. No, she wasn't mad. She goes, oh, I'll change them. No problem. You know, and we kept going. And so that was, you know, that was a pretty interesting trip. And then at the end of it, we're out of the cave and, you know, people are getting ready to leave. And I take out my little address book. You know, we didn't have cell phones or nothing back then. I have my little address book and I write down all their names. Danny Dybul, and I think it was Danny, which Greg McNamara, and Tony.
Okay.
And under Tony, I put in parentheses, long red hair.
Ah.
So, you know, I was with somebody at the time, you know, so I didn't meet up with Tony again until Tagpole Cave-In. It was like, is it like 95 or 94, I think. And Pat, I was living with Pat at the time.
Oh, really?
So I had a good job. You know, I was working as a chemist. I was caving every weekend, living with two girls. I had the life, you know. It was great. And she goes, we went to Tagpole Cave-In, and she goes, oh, there's this really good band playing tonight. And she goes, all the Indiana boys will be there, and they all love to dance. And we both Pat and I, kind of have similar tastes in music. And I was like, okay, well, let's go, you know. And that's when I really met Tony.
Yeah.
And I think we danced like the whole night. We didn't even say anything to each other. And then that was it. I think within a year I was moved.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Moved to Ohio. He lived in Ohio at the time.
Oh, what a great story.
Yeah. Yeah. So Pat, yeah, she's always been a mentor to me, always really helped me. She helped me not only learn how to survey sketch, but she taught me how to draft maps. And at that time, we were using Mylar ink pens.
Yeah.
Sets of ink pens and Mylar. So that's what I was doing back then, you know, and that changed. Mm. But, and then moving to Ohio, then, you know, then all of a sudden I'm swallowed up by Tony's group.
Yeah.
And started caving with all them, Danny and Greg and Ron and...
Did you get into Lechuguilla?
I did.
Yeah.
I did.
Through them? Through Pat?
More through Pat. So one of them was a bat research expedition. This was in 95, too. And one of them was a Learn expedition where I was a sketcher. So
man.
I just did two trips in there. Yeah. Pretty amazing cave. Yeah.
Did you get to see the highlights or did you go to a different frontier?
Yeah. I mean, I got to see, you know, the Chandelier Ballroom.
Mm.
I got to see some pretty neat stuff. The whole rift went down that. So a lot of vertical. It was a lot for me at that age, you know, at that point. And I couldn't really go out there a lot, you know, but that was pretty neat that I got to. I mean, it's, you know, you're like walking in a geode.
Yeah.
And the only thing brown is the trail. I mean, there are rooms like that where you're just surrounded by crystals and formations. And it's a hot cave.
Yeah, it's like 72 degrees or something,
so
right?
You're not cold. You know, so, yeah, they were camp trips, you know. So they were hard. It was hard, but they were neat. You know, I was glad I got to go to do that.
So you're with Tony. And then,
but that wasn't with Tony.
But that wasn't with Tony.
No.
But at this
but one
time,
one of them was. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
You're with Tony, and then a few years later, Mexico starts.
Yes.
For you, anyway.
Yes, I had. Well, Tony was already going to Mexico, so he had started like 92 or 93 with just Joe Oliphant, Tina Shirk, who later became Tina Oliphant, mm-hmm. and him, and that's when they started. So I didn't come into that until like 97, I believe, is when I first started, the winter of 97. But my first trip to Mexico was with a tag group.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
the old buddies?
Yeah.
The buddies you had been caving with?
Yeah, I mean, it was, I think at that point, I hadn't moved to Ohio at that point. It was to the El Cielo Biosphere Reserve, a little further north in Mexico. And I was riding with Chris and Julie Hudson. And it was a pretty classic group. You know, Alan Kressler, Randy Porter, Jim Smith, Ted Wilson, Doug Strait, Marion Smith, Rocco, John Stemble, and a couple other folks, I'm sure. So it was a pretty classic trip. One thing that happened that was pretty interesting. At that time, you know, they were really competitive down in tag amongst each other. You know, some of the tag cavers, Jim Smith, I guess in one, he would do whatever he could do to be the first one to do things, to okay. find things.
Yeah.
So they were scared of Jim Smith, like, scooping them. So they had called me over one night. It was Alan and Ted, I think. And they said, look, we found this cave. It's a really, really pretty pit. And we want you to survey it tomorrow. But we don't want you to say anything about it. So, you know, I went along with that because they were scared that Jim Smith would get up at 4 a.m. and go do it.
Wow.
It's just that, you know, they were all really good friends and did all this exploration together, but it was just, I guess, strong competition.
Yeah.
And so that was a neat, I got to do that pit, survey that pit, and it was real pretty.
That's
300
cool.
footer. Yeah, it was really nice. So that was a neat trip. But then, yeah, so then in the next winter is when I started going with Tony down there in the winter.
Yeah.
And they had already had a couple trips up into the Lost City. At that point, we were hiking from the main road, which now you can actually go, you know, more roads are paved. And in later years, we were able to drive quite a bit further up before we parked. But at that point, you know, and they're carrying, I don't know what I was carrying, 50 to 70 pounds. They're probably carrying 80-plus pound packs. And then getting up to the top and then having to hike to the Lost City. Mm. One of the trips we had to hike our gear in for 3 days. Like we had help getting the gear up to that point. But then we had to go back and forth to get it all in the Lost City.
Wow.
So they were pretty rugged trips. You know, we had to collect water. And this was virgin because this was like an elevated valley. So there was no logging had gone on in this area at all. So it was really pristine. And
so can you describe, you said elevated valley. This, you're talking about the Lost City, right?
Yeah.
Can you kind of describe this area?
Well, it's cloud forest environment, so real lush, thick, wet, you know, a lot of humidity. Up on high, you know, when we hiked a whole day to go up, you know, nobody lived up there. There was one family that lived up there.
Wow.
A man, his wife, and their three sons.
They farmed there? I mean, how do you live there?
Yeah, I mean, they didn't have a lot of contact with down below.
Okay.
They had a spring. They had water. They farmed. The older man didn't wear shoes. You know, they didn't. At one point, I remember he getting a big spine in his foot and Joe kind of doing medical treatment on his foot. Trying to help clean it, keep it clean. And so we're in a pretty, you know, they're a pretty primitive area. And they took to us. I mean, we kind of, you know, they were suspicious, but they ended up trusting us. And so that was a really neat period. And the Swiss had been going there. I think they started going there in the 80s, but they had two nice, very nice publications that were made in 90 and 94, just beautiful publications of all the caves that they'd found. This was more around Cerro Caballero, so it was a little bit of a distance, but they actually hiked in one day, two of them, and found the Breath of Oz total, but they didn't do it. They were just on a day trip.
This is
one of the pits that Tony and they ended up surveying and doing, the deepest, one of the deepest, the deepest.
The deepest.
The deepest, a 900-foot pit.
One pit, 900 feet? Wow.
And they never went back and did it. And they, Tony and them, even got a hold of them. They said, look, we found your flagging at the top of this pit, and we're going to this area now. You know, can we go do this pit? So they found it, but they ended up not being able to really go back there and, you know, kind of reluctantly gave their approval. And Tony, Danny, and Mark Peterson who ended up surveying and doing that pit. Mm. And it was December 31st, 1998. it was really a neat time.
Yeah.
The last of those expeditions was 2001, winter of 2001. And I was actually pregnant with Simon.
Did you know?
Oh, yeah. I was like 6 months.
Oh, okay. All right.
So we went up and we went there and we helped him get permission. And that was a good expedition for them, too. They did a lot of surveying and had some good sketchers.
So you're bushwhacking with a belly?
No.
Not really?
We helped them get permission with the
authorities. Oh, okay. You were just kind of...
Okay,
gotcha.
Yeah, so we helped them deal with all that initially, and then they went. And then had started our business in 98.
Carlota Gardens?
Yeah. Well, it was A to Z Imports.
Oh, different.
Back then.
Okay.
A to Z. So my maiden name is Zeman's.
Yeah.
He was Acres. So we started A to Z Imports.
There you go. Okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, that kind of has a different story there, the beginning of that. But when we had Simon, it was kind of our focus for the next 4 or 5 years. You know how
babies are.
It takes, you know, we still did a ton of stuff, but it takes a lot more time.
So I am curious about, it started as A to Z and then Carlota Gardens. So this was, I talked to Tony at Capers last year.
A little bit about it.
You guys are like cultural ambassadors, essentially. I mean, you're importing art, but I mean, you wouldn't have known about it had you not been going down there.
What was the genesis of this idea? You know, because Tony had been going down there since, you know, the early 90s.
Yeah.
And every time they'd go into one of the cities or something, you know, he'd pick up little stuff, black pottery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's so much art in Mexico. It's really amazing. So he would bring back things and for gifts and things like that. But we hadn't really started anything. It was, you know, it was more just that. But he kind of had that dream.
Yeah.
You know, wow, I could bring this stuff back. So he was working at Honda Manufacturing. Long time.
Yeah.
And when I moved to Ohio, I actually got a job there at Honda. I got an engineering position and you know, it was a great job, secure, best money I'd ever made.
Yeah.
But
you
got
a chemistry background.
I have a chemistry. Yeah, I have a chemistry degree, but I hated it. Oh my God. I mean, they were like trying to bring in college graduates to kind of spruce up the area, you know, the department. And the managers that were there had all worked their way up from line. They weren't college educated or anything.
Yeah.
So they didn't really like all these college grads. So like my manager didn't like me. Then they started putting me on night shift, and we were already driving like close to an hour to get to work.
Yeah. Oh my gosh.
So it was like all of a sudden I'm on night shift. I had just moved to Ohio, and now I'm you know having to do this job I hated. So within 3 months, I quit. Tony pretty much made me quit because I was that miserable. I just hated it. And I was like, well, I didn't move to Ohio for this. You know, my career didn't seem to be as much of a focus anymore. Chemistry, I didn't really like to work in a lab full of chemicals. It seems kind of weird, but chemistry challenged me as a college student. I went from psychology to art to accounting to chemistry.
Yeah.
So
all right.
Maybe I should have done biology. But anyway, whatever.
Water
right?
under the bridge
if,
now.
If. So anyway, so we decided at that point we would actually give the art thing a go.
Yeah.
And I started working temporary jobs. So I would get temporary office jobs. And when Tony had a shutdown period, you know, because these plants, they'll have shutdown periods that you get paid for. So he would put his vacation around a shutdown period, and we would run to Mexico in our vehicle, straight without stopping. We usually drag somebody else with us so they could help drive. And
from Ohio to Mexico.
At 25 hours to the border, another 10 to 15 to when we actually stopped, and further south to where our all the art was. We started gathering art books. We just grabbed a book and said, we're just going to go here. We're going to find this lacquer work. We're going to go to Olina La Guerrero. We're going to go to San Bartolome, Coyotepec in Oaxaca and get the black pottery. So
what an adventure.
So it's like, so Tony was still working, right? And I was just doing temp jobs. And we started bringing back art, and I'd make little books, photo books. My last permanent job, and I got hired here. I was an administrative assistant for an executive for Victoria's Secret. her name was Marion, too, actually.
Oh, Marion and Marion.
I learned a lot there. I learned how cutthroat they can be, for sure. Ugh. And I also learned sketching. I went to the stores and drew the plans out, and you know, it was a really good job. I secure job. She loved me because I was a little worker bee. And you know, and I told her, I was like, look, in a year we're opening up our own store. She was like, okay, yeah, okay, Marianne, that's okay. You know, like, she didn't believe me, you know. And I'd bring in my little art books with all our little Mexican treasures, and oh, here, you know, I'd sell a little thing here and there. You know, we didn't make any money then. You know, the pickup load, you don't really make any money.
Yeah, know? Yeah.
But in a year, I quit. And we
true
opened,
to your word.
True to my word. And we opened up a little store, and we started selling consignment, and we started doing shows. You know, the shows were good back then. And I'm trying to remember when Tony actually quit, but eventually he quit. Mm-hmm. Honda, too. Mm-hmm. And we had a store in an outlet mall. You know, we really kept growing. I mean, it took a lot. And we were doing long trips to Mexico, exploring just for business.
Just for art, yeah.
Just for art, all over Mexico. And at one time, we were selling like 20 to 30 different kinds of art from Mexico.
Wow.
And, you know, we had a retail store. We did that. And, you know, even had furniture and rugs and, you know, all kinds of neat stuff. And it, you know, it took a long time. I mean, we took a long time to get to where we are right now.
Yeah.
And A to Z changed to Carlota Gardens 2009 because we had a bankruptcy. And, you know, we learned a lot of lessons there. Now we have a pretty, I mean, I wouldn't say we make a lot of money, but we have a successful business.
You can say that, yeah.
We can say that. We don't have to have any other source of money. We have a stable wholesale business. It's still growing. COVID actually spurred its growth because we sell garden pottery.
people are out in their backyard.
Yeah, so it's still growing and changing. And Mexico is just a wonderful country, you know, full of wonderful, nice, genuine people. I mean, the smaller villages that you go to, the better.
Mm.
You know, they're hospitable. The food is amazing. I can't barely go to a Mexican restaurant here
enjoy
it.
Well, it's Tex-Mex. It's not
Tex-Mex,
Mexican.
Yeah, all that cheesy stuff and all that, you know. So real Mexican food, authentic.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, just amazing. I mean, and in the Sierra Mazateca, I mean, they make their own tortillas. Handmade tortillas. They're not from a tortilla factory.
Yeah.
So they're amazing.
Yeah.
And the beans. I mean, just simple cooked beans I've had are some of the most amazing food in the world.
So when you're down there, is it hard to, I mean, and I know caving to a degree is business. It's not money-making business, but it's serious business for you and Tony. When you're down there, is it hard to balance the business with the caving?
No, because we kept that totally separate.
Okay.
Really. So I mean, when we started going back to the Sierra, it was more like 2004 or something. Mm. We started going back there, and you know, Tony had met in his early years, had met Waldo Romero Garcia, who owned a coffee plantation, Cafetal Carlota.
Heard about Waldo.
A wonderful man, a diplomat. He loved
talking, loved being with people. He was genuine, honorable, very much a father figure for Tony, and taught us a lot about the Sierra and the subtleties of behavior, respect, you know, just a really, and he opened his door to us, and I learned about coffee. By the time we got there, coffee, you know, they can't make money, couldn't make money with coffee anymore.
Really?
It's a slightly bad elevation, a little too low, and global coffee prices had really forced, there was no work in coffee anymore. But he taught us how to do it. I mean, I've picked coffee, I've processed it from the bean all the way.
It's a whole thing.
And yeah, I've roasted it how they roast it. You know, so I did learn a ton about coffee. We almost wanted to import it, but just the regulations here in the States are very strict. You know, you'd have to have a food grade warehouse, and it was too hard. You had to be a roaster to do that.
Gotcha.
We almost could have made money if we would have sold it within Mexico, but we kind of abandoned that. But so, yeah, when we started going back there and being with Waldo and seeing it at the ranch, didn't do a lot of caving. You know, Simon was still pretty small, and we would do some of the local pits. And, you know, Tony and I would go. Somebody would help us find a, you know, go to the pit, and one of us would go down, and Simon would stay up.
Is he 20 this year?
He's 20.
He's 20 now.
Yeah.
That's wild.
He's in college, and he's caving.
Is he caving?
He's caving.
I mean, I knew he stuck with it, but...
Well, but, you know, we took him everywhere, right?
Yeah. It's just what he knew.
It's what he knew. So it was almost like, you know, it was like, does he really love it? You know, does he really like it? And, of course, yeah, I think the Binkley, you know, the muddy, wet stuff and the digging, you know, he's not real crazy about. But he loves the vertical. He loves the challenge. He loved when we started the Mexico expeditions up again. He loved all those crazy cavers coming, and he loved doing all of that. And so now he's actually is doing project work with us, and he's strong and smart and got a good sense of direction. He's good in the wilderness. Mm-hmm. Now we're running after him.
Yeah. Of course, he's 20.
So, you know, once we started going back to the Sierra again in the winters, we ended up meeting Ernie Garza, just this wonderful man from Texas, a small guy, but very just genuine, sweet, loved caving, loved the Sierra. And he started coming to the ranch with us. And, you know, it was just us at the time. And we started doing different things. He'd take us, you know, different places, and we'd look for caves, and some of the other Texas cavers come down. Bill Steele was one of them. And like one trip, like I didn't realize how young Simon was. I've just looked at this picture, and it's Bill Steele, and he's rappelling down this into this cave called Coffee Tal Carlota Cave. And it's not a real deep pit, more of like a slopey pit.
Yeah.
But at the very bottom, there's like a 6-foot drop off. So you kind of have to be on rope.
Mm-hmm.
So he tethered Simon, and Simon's like 5. And I looked it up. I was like, he was 5. So he tethered Simon down into this cave. we took him everywhere.
Yeah.
We tried to do everything with him, you know. And Ernie was also somebody who he introduced us to Mike Frazier at a party or something. Ernie was like, well, drop me off here. I'm going to meet my friend Mike. So we met Mike Frazier and his Colorado friends, and that was kind of instrumental. Mike is a really good caver, been going to the Sierra as long, or if not even a little longer. He was involved in exploration of Quijai Chantois. At the time, he was doing exploration in a cave called Tres Amigos. So we met him there, and he loved the Sierra too. He had that same, so it was kind of like an instant kind of connection. And we all just started dreaming about caving and what we could do. Let's sit and talk and talk and talk. And so that kind of actually started up trips again.
Yeah.
So about 2011 or so, we were going there every winter and having more people come. We went to a variety of areas there, not just one. There's lots of caves everywhere. But Landa, you know, relations there are difficult. Where people are a little suspicious. You really have to show them you're genuine. You have to take your time with the people there.
Sure.
And Americans, you know, generally are fast. You know, they come in with a goal and they want to go do it. And, you know, if you don't have but 2 weeks, of course, you can't take that time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we kind of had a different approach as far as being with the people in the mountains and really taking that time to hang with them, talk with them, eat with them, get to know them, and as well as get a guide, get porters, work with them to make this happen. And we always had school supplies. Like, we always made arrangements to get a bunch of school supplies so we could give it to the kids in the region, because, you know, we felt like, well, the kids, they're going to be the ones that eventually might make a difference here.
Yeah.
And, you know, my dream was always was to try and protect that area, you know, from exploitation and logging and turn it into a biosphere or something. But was pretty hard to do. I never really could ever really achieve that.
Yeah. There are lots of forces at work. So
yes.
It's not really.
It's like we didn't have the resources to really make something like that happen. But it's such a magical area. I mean, you know, and some parts of it are protected federally. They have the Serra Ocotal above Carlota has a big forest of acote trees, and it's a type of pine tree. You know the wood that are fire sticks? They just stay burning. Mm. It's got that high level of pine resin. And then that's a cote.
Oh, okay.
And those are federally protected. So, you know, the ranch and the Carlota, and we'd go there not just for expeditions, but we kind of lived there part of the year, several months. I homeschooled Simon part of his education, not all of it. It's kind of part private, part public. And so it's kind of our home there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we really loved it there.
Would you say that's the genesis of Proyecto Sierra Mazateca, or was the genesis of that what Tony had been doing for years prior?
I'd say the genesis was when he started with Danny and Greg
okay.
and Ron.
It just didn't really have that name yet.
No. We turned it into that.
Yeah.
And several of those guys did come. Ron came for many years once we started back up in 2011. Greg came several times. Danny never came again. I'd say Danny is part of that genesis.
Yeah.
Him and Joe Oliphant, Tony and Tina, they were the genesis. Joe and Tina ended up moving to Montana and never ended up coming back down to Mexico with us. But the expeditions were different, too. It wasn't what we were doing with Danny. We were hiking in the jungle. We did have jungle camps, but we worked more with the local community, and we had porters. We weren't carrying quite as much up the mountain, although we'd set up a jungle camp and stay up there and, you know, did lots of exploration. And, you know, I think total we ended up finding and surveying 129 different caves or pits, features.
And there's no shortage there.
A bunch of pits that, you know, more or less blind pits, some really neat caves as well. Not anything that was turned into a system.
Mm.
So we never really found that system, you know, that, say, Huautla or Cheve, we never really got there. But we found a lot of caves and had. We're in some areas that no one has gone back to.
Yeah.
And you're hard to get to.
I am curious about that. I mean, what do you know about why that might be the case that you didn't really find a major system or something? Is it just not the right kind of rock, not the right kind of area?
I don't know. Mm. You know, we'd bottom the pit and try and find
There's some cave down there sometimes, but sometimes it's just a pit.
Yeah. I mean, a couple of them were multi-drops and pretty, and a couple of the other caves were horizontals that were lower in elevation, so they were more horizontal. But most of them were all shafts, open-air shafts, and, you know, we just never got lucky there, I guess.
Still cool to find, though.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We had some great trips. So,
wow.
Yeah. And I know later in the expeditions, 2016, Thomas Hawkins.
Yeah. I just had him on.
Yeah. So I think he told you the story about how we met at the Philadelphia Flower Show.
Because
that was one of our big art, pottery garden shows that we did. So we met there. He also knew Terry Raines and a couple other Texas cavers. So we had that connection. And we started and, you know, brought him in. And he was just kind of amazed because Tony just had such good relationships with the people. We went right to the source. And he was pretty thrilled to be a part of that. And we just love Thomas. I mean, he's just a great, great guy. Sure, you've seen that.
I mean, he's been a lot of places and seen a lot of different caves, and he seems like he's down for anything.
He is. He's positive. I mean, he's 65. He can outrun most of us in the cave and up the mountain. He's someone who I would go to for any type of advice. He has a lot of knowledge and about indigenous cultures. He's been in lots of parts of the world. Thomas can evaluate a political situation, or especially down there, instantly. He's an excellent judge of character. I mean, he's just top notch. I can't say enough about Thomas. He's always there. He's always willing to help. He's always smiling. You know, he laughs at us, too. I mean, because we're just like this crazy group of cavers, you know. and he was used to, you know, botany expeditions, you know, where they'd work from 8 to 5 collecting plants and leaves and a little more serious. And we're just kind of off the wall. But then he was amazed that, you know, we're out there doing it. You know, we're not just partying or just having fun. We're out there caving and we do stuff. So Thomas is still part of our caving life today, even though we haven't gone to Mexico a little bit. So
that's great.
He's still doing stuff.
I'm so thankful to have made Thomas's acquaintance.
Yeah, he's incredible. You know, during this time, Mexico, we're also doing a lot of caving here.
Yeah.
You know, in the upper 90s, in year 2000, we're doing lots of stuff and doing some Indiana stuff. The group went to Tag a lot. We've done some great exploration. Rusty's Resounding Rock Drop was a big one.
Yeah.
And most of them involve some kind of dig as well. Even those down there, like Rusty's Resounding Rock Drop, the entrance was dug open. The first pit initially had this thing in it called the shoulder block. It was the kind of thing where it was really, 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 really tight. You kind of went down the slope about 10 to 15 feet, and then you dropped down the pit in between this, you know, rock walls. Really tight, you know, and I'm small, okay? But it was so tight.
And you're doing this with gear on and on rope?
Well, yeah, we're on rope.
Yeah.
So, of course, when you're going down, you know, you kind of slide down, right? Gravity takes you down. But when you're going up.
It's probably really hard going up.
So, like, it took 20 minutes to move about 6 inches.
Oh, gosh.
So you're, like, just kind of pushing, you know, and you're one arm up, you know, one arm back, and you're pushing, you know, and you're just moving. I'm going, okay, I think I moved like a millimeter or something. Let me just keep going. And so I don't know how the bigger guys really did it, but that was one of the real, you know, tight spots. And then there's about 5 different digs in that cave. And we ended up, the bottom of that, there was this nasty canyon that you pretty much had to rig to go through, or you just kind of slide down inside it.
Yeah.
So at that point, the cave is getting really hard. And a couple of the folks, we had some hard, cold trips that, you know, a couple of the guys are like, I'm just not going in there again. And Elliot Stahl, he's always kind of piggybacked on the group, learned a lot from the group, yeah. You know, as well as learning a lot from Marion Smith and everything. And, you know, and he's kind of, he's, you know, he was the one always jumping the small water crawl and do it first or something at the very bottom. So Elliot is like, you know, I want to take my buddies in there. And do the cave, you know, and I had kind of had to talk Danny into it. I'll let him go in there. So he goes in there, and he's supposed to survey, right, this yeah. canyon that we didn't survey.
Yeah.
And he doesn't.
he just goes.
He just goes. He did it, got to the bottom. He comes out, and, you know, he tells us about it, you know, and I'm kind of, you know, kind of giving him a hard time. I was like, man, you got to survey that thing. You know, you should have surveyed it. Da-da-da-da-da. He went back. And did it. Took, I think, Marty Abercrombie, Alan Gross. He went back and surveyed it.
Paid his dues.
And I was able to finish the map. That one ended up being like, you know, 415 feet deep. And but that was one of the classics. Young's Creek Blowhole was another one. It was about 600 feet deep. Another classic. 17 Stitches, another classic we did. And you need to get Danny Dibel on here.
So I would love to talk to him.
I don't know if he would, but
I bet I could get him.
But he's—I would say Danny is one of the premier explorers of his generation.
Well, the man just doesn't stop.
No, and he really has documented everything he's done, and he's an excellent sketcher too. If mapping hadn't gone digital, he'd have been a great cartographer.
Mm.
But he never really went. Went digital, but
it's a hard transition.
Yeah, yeah, but he's still one of the strongest cavers I know. Mm. I mean, so phenomenal. And I learned so much from those guys, as much as I learned from Pat about surveying, you know, and the right way to do it, back shots, and, you know, being exact, doing all three views when I sketch, you know, plan, profile, and cross section. When I started surveying with them, they were very much into keeping the top standard because they knew they had heard about all the problems like La Chiquilla had with not loop closures being bad and all that. So they made sure they did it right. So actually, you know, I always felt like that I learned so much from following them around, you know, how to cave, how to stay in the cave because they like to stay in the cave and carried lots of stuff, real heavy packs, but we loved the cave. We wanted to be in there. When I started caving with them, like, I couldn't even cave with tag cavers anymore because they're so fast. And then Danny's style, their style is slow and deliberate. So
I've been on one ridge walk with Danny, and that was it. And in one cave on that ridge walk. And just to see him in that element.
Carrying the topo.
It's really something.
Yeah. Yeah, phenomenal. That whole group, I mean, just phenomenal cavers.
Yeah.
And such good friends. I mean, it was our friendship, too, that made all those trips really, really special.
Mm. What is this? Cerro Caballero?
Oh, okay. Yeah, that trip. Okay, so where is this jungle camp? Close to Cerro Caballero, and it's north of the Lost City area. So one day it was a Sunday, we hike and we start exploring and we get to the north edge of the Lost City. And we see they've been logging ridge line by ridge line and
illegal logging.
Well, we didn't know anything at the time, really. We didn't see very many people. I think one of the groups saw one person. And it was because it was a Sunday, and that's what we realized. And we actually got to this pit, and it was like a five-second drop down this pit. And it was the very north end of the Lost City, so we were right there. I mean, we were right back to where they were back in the late 90s. And so everybody was super excited. You know, we got back to camp,
And like, I think the next day they had had a trip planned to another, a big pit that was kind of far away. They had had that set up with somebody. So a big group went there and did that. And I stayed back at camp, and we just kind of rested at camp and cleaned up, and actually had my first bath, you know, had collected water and was going to take my first bath, and was taking my first bath by my campsite, and saw a Mazatec like 50 feet down on the ridge side coming up, looking at me. I'm like, oh, well, this is the first time I'm taking a bath, and now I've got to see somebody. So I had to kind of like hurry up, finish up, and jump in the tent. I mean, by that time, he's almost at the tent. He starts talking to me, and, you know, and I talk to him a little bit here and there, and, you know, nothing real bad or anything. And he goes, and I go back to the main camp area or kitchen area, and I start telling him, like, look, I just saw this man, and he's asking me all these questions and what's going on. And
you're telling him what your business is there.
I'm telling him we're caving, and yeah, we have permission from San Jose Tenango, the municipality there. And within about half hour, a whole group of like 10 to 15 men armed with guns and several police officers from Tenango come into our camp.
Whoa.
They'd found us.
Okay.
So they had seen that we were all in there work area, and we're wondering what we were doing. And so, you know, I wasn't fully aware, like, their guns were cocked and loaded.
They're ready, yeah.
And, like, Adam Schreier was with us, and he knew that. He saw that right away, you know, and he could speak Spanish. I spoke some Spanish, and so we started talking to him, and we showed him, you know, some of our pictures, and we thought we had, you know, kind of smooth things over, and we're, you know, try to explain what we were doing. But it turns out they had filed a complaint within the municipality. They were part of a smaller village within the municipality, and they were logging, and it was illegal. Mm-hmm. But the municipality itself, Tenango, had actually been shut down for several years. They had voting issues. They had conflicts. They had no central government within this one, like, municipality, like a county. They had no central government going on for a couple years. But they were such a large group that we had no say.
So you thought you had covered your bases with the local authorities, you really kind of hadn't, because it was not.
Because we were coming, although we were in Tenango doing what, you know, we said we were going to try and do. They were, you know, angry that we were, they thought we were disturbing their work area. Mm. And we're going to, and who knows what was going on then. We don't really know exactly at that point what they were doing. And we just knew that, you know, they were like, well, Tony was kind of considered the leader. And like, Tony needs to come down. Tony needs to come down tomorrow, and we're going to have a meeting. So they come back from their big, huge, long day, 12, 14-hour day, and all of a sudden get the bombshell that we've had armed men up at our camp, angry and wondering what we were doing, and known that we were in their work area, and that Tony and I had to go down. So the next day, Tony and I hiked down, and we thought we had smoothed things over with these guys. We left them shaking hands, smiling, you know, but no. It was not a good situation, and they wanted us out of there. You know, in the Tenango, the officials, the president there, they couldn't fight them. They couldn't say, you know, they couldn't defend us, even though they knew we were basically just doing a tourist activity. It wasn't anything harmful or anything, but they couldn't defend us. So they were like, no, you need to come down. I'm like, well, give us a day to get all our gear together. No, you need to come down. So we had to hike up, and we basically had to come down the next day.
Oh,
so it was that was really harsh to have our expedition just ended without any real warning. And to know that those guys were logging illegally in the Lost City was kind of That's pretty rough. It just felt off. We just felt awful and helpless. We couldn't really do anything. We knew we had just left
wonderful caving area, and that we, you know, we couldn't go back there. We did end up going to another area closer to Carlota, San Juan Quetzalcoatl, and ended up forming a relationship there where we went the next year.
Mm-hmm.
and did a pit up there even directly after this. And these guys were actually a different culture, Mixtec. So they were kind of outsiders in a way, outside of the Mazatec community. They were Mixtec. Tony made friends. We got one hike up there, did one of the big pits up there, and had a great expedition the next year there in San Juan.
Yeah.
Very beautiful area. You know, it's just very difficult there that the people, they've had so many outsiders come from different parts of the world and steal from them their archaeology and not given much back.
Yeah.
So
you can understand their suspicions.
Yeah. Well, you can sort of, but like at the end of that great expedition there, we realized there was a fringe group that thought we were trying to take their children. I mean, we've even been accused of being part of an oil company looking for oil. So it's like that's hard when you just want to help, you know, you're just wanting to give some children their own school supplies, a little backpack, and then you've got people accusing you of trying to take their children. And, you know, so it's just, you know, just hurt it. It hurt us. Mm-hmm. And Tony has put so much effort and formed so many great relationships there. So those were hard experiences, you know. We were robbed once at the ranch. Mm. Things were taken. Witchcraft a little bit. We've had body parts were left, goat parts were left outside of the ranch.
Oh, wow.
Which is pretty scary.
Yeah.
You know, this is a kind of a mystical, magical area. And like part of their religion involves the use of mushrooms. It's a kind of magical place. But they also believe in curses, things that are a little, you know, scary too.
Yeah. Just the fact that they harbor whether you believe it or not, just the fact that they harbor those thoughts about you is just kind of unsettling.
It is. It is. And we're going to an area that's evolving very quickly. The modern world, you know, computers are now common and cell phones are common. But when we first started, there were dirt roads.
Yeah.
They'd never seen outsiders. You know, so we're seeing in this area grow and evolve. We're coming in and changing them, too. Yeah. They're changing us and we're changing them. So it's like this dual. And there's still groups going there and they still have relationships in different areas and they're not bad. They're good. They've been able to manage all these things with some casualties, with some areas closed off, too, from events happening and mistakes made. Like you can't take any locals in the cave. If you take anybody in the cave and they see anything valuable, they're going to come back in and take it.
Oh, wow.
So it's like, you know, and also if you give too much, you know, if you start bringing, like we would bring clothes and, you know, we would try and give and help people. But those envy and jealousy, you see that so clearly. Mm. So when people have too much and they're given something, then their neighbor's jealous. You know, so it's a really difficult place to manage, you know, because you want to help and share and give these people something more than what they have, but you can also do damage doing that.
Yeah.
So
5 years on from that sort of pivotal moment, I mean, the project's evolved a little bit for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
Based on that.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I'll talk about the last trip a little bit. 2020. We had a pretty good expedition planned. I don't know, about 20 people maybe. We try not to have too many people because it's just too much for the locals. But, and this had been coming in. And I was trying to ignore it. The cartels, they were coming in the area. Man. I don't know if it was a route for migrants or what, or they were just wanting to take control of this area. But, you know, there was we started here and there was cartel trouble. We were trying to plan two different areas. Mike Frazier had an area that he had in mind, and we had an area in San Juan Cuautzlan, which didn't end up panning out. And the president in Jalapa de Diaz was very friendly, open, wanted to have ecotourism there. Mike had a good relationship with them, and the cartels started coming in, and he was killed at a Christmas party with two other officials, right at a Christmas party.
Wow.
Gunned down. And various deaths had been happening in the area the year before, the fall before, and different things were happening. People were scared. At that point, when that happened, everything was off and nothing was going to happen. And of course, half of our group dropped, didn't come.
Right.
Obviously, you know.
Don't want to be involved.
Yeah. But we had a small group there already. So the tourist director in the area, they were devoted to that president, and he really believed that, you know, he wanted this to happen. So she turned around and said, okay, you know, you guys can still come. So we set up our camp. You know, we found a cave, a neat cave. That Mike had found a neat cave and didn't find a lot there. But the tourist director's brother was our guide, a wonderful man. And he just fell in love with caving. We all made friends really quick. He loved our camp. Like, we'd play music at night. Aida and Mike would play guitar and we'd sing, and he just loved it. We thought we'd take him in this cave. He really wanted to go in the cave. So we taught him vertical, got him set up, taught him knots. I mean, he was like a child who had discovered how to ride a bike. When he watched him making knots over and over, the smile on his face, and just the sweetest guy. And he went in the cave with us. But there was still stuff going on with the cartel, and there was like even a mass phone text that went out, threatened. There was a lot of threats in there, death threats, and they named a date and everything. And at that point, we were like, you know, we just need to get out of here.
Yeah.
We ended up, you know, leaving a couple days early, getting out of there, and actually did disperse the school supplies. We're going to have a pleasant afternoon with the authorities and eat with them, but another thing happened in town, and another death happened.
Wow.
You know, a local adult doctor, you know, and so it was like, okay, we got to get out of here. You know, all of a sudden you see all these cell phones come up in the town, and all everybody's got this panic look on their face, and then we had to leave. So we ended up going back home, most of us. Tony and Aida stayed there at the ranch. I think Mike and Donna were still there. I was about a week back home. And our friend, the guide, you know, the tourist director's brother, he was going to come help Tony and Aida de-rig this neat cave that we had in our property. A cave that was 150 foot from our back door that we had just found 2 years previous. A beautiful, beautiful cave. He was going to come help de-rig it. And he was shot down and killed.
Oh, my gosh.
So it was like,
I'm
you
so
know,
sorry.
It was just the most traumatic experience. Just when they called and told us that happened, it was so scary. You know, it was like, Tony, get out of there. Get out of that area now. You know, what if they found the ranch? What if, you know, they knew about us? What if, you know, there was about a 24-hour period where they were at the ranch just cleaning up, and there's no Wi-Fi. So I didn't have any idea what was going on with them. You know, and I just felt all these different emotions there, you know, grief, anger, guilt. You know, we had no idea if we were part of that. There was another cartel at the top of the mountain that had turf wars with this other, you know. So there was all this stuff going on. For all we know, even the logging had cartel connections back 4 years, you know, 3 years previous. We don't know, you know. So for me, it was hard. I think it was harder for me than for other people, because it was my home.
Yeah.
You know, Sierra's my home. And to know that now I'm afraid, you know, there's nothing like going somewhere and being afraid, you know. So it was pretty traumatic, and I couldn't even talk about it. I mean, I couldn't even, I think for about 6 months or something, I mean, I couldn't talk about it at all. None of it. I didn't want anything to do with
it. It's heartbreaking.
Yeah, it was heartbreaking. He had 4 children. And so to have that kind of involvement and to realize what's going on in Mexico, you know, I mean, I believe that the whole country's controlled, myself, all the way to the top, you know, and going into Central and South America too. People don't realize what kind of threat that really is. Yeah. Like entire mafias controlled the government, and they don't just do drugs either. It's they filter money, you know. They get a position in the government and they start filtering whatever, you know. So that's kind of devastating.
So was 2020 it
for me? Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And it, well, then COVID hit.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. So even when, you know, and Tony's been going back, but for a while there, it was like he didn't want to go into the Sierra just because what if he was accused of bringing COVID and someone got sick?
Right.
And we've known several people that have died. They don't have enough medical facilities there in the mountains to deal with COVID. Mm. Anybody who had a medical condition or over 50 was generally.
Like that was it.
They were going to have a very hard time unless they made it to a bigger hospital.
Wow.
And vaccines, you know, I don't know how it is now, but I know when we were all getting vaccines and you could call up, make an appointment in 15 minutes, you were done, right?
Yeah.
Oh, in Mexico, you had to wait in line for 2 days in your vehicle and not leave your vehicle.
Oh, my God.
In the cities, if you wanted a vaccine. So it was a lot harder to even deal with COVID, and you know, so I think that's over now.
Yeah.
And there's been expeditions back, you know, to Wautlin and Cheve, and I don't think they've had any problems. I almost think that, like, if you have a visa, you're somewhat protected.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're a Mexican national, you can disappear. Mm-hmm. If you look up the numbers, it's like 30,000 to 50,000 a year.
Wow.
Unsolved deaths. So, yeah, it's pretty – I think it's one of the most serious things that are going on, but it's not really most people's radar.
Are you eager to get back or are you still a little hesitant?
Well, I want to go back to the ranch. I want to see my family down there. We have a godchild.
Yeah.
I don't know that I really want to have a big expedition and be a big part of that right yet.
Mm-hmm.
So, but, you know – that's life, right? I mean, things have a beginning and an ending sometimes, and maybe mm-hmm. that's it. I don't think it's it for Tony, and I'm not saying never say never. I do want to go back, mm-hmm. and I've gotten over most of what that was, but yeah, it'll be strange when I do.
And there you have it. Got a little heavy there at the end, and I really hope that all is well in that world and that things get better for Proyecto Sierra Mazateca. And, of course, be back next month for part 2 with Marian Akers. And thank you so much for listening to this podcast. Support this podcast by supporting our sponsors, past and present. Our current sponsor, Sophie Reaptress. Get a custom cave suit from sophiereaptress.com. The link is in the description of this podcast. Also, thanks to Swago, swagogear.com. Thanks to El Spelio, some of the best lights you can find. I believe they're now being sold by OnRope One. Also, Organic Robot Designs. Does your grotto need t-shirts? Do you need t-shirts for whatever reason? OrganicRobotDesigns.com or the brick and mortar store in Greenfield, Indiana. Charlie Vetters is our current chair of the Central Indiana Grotto, and that's his business. You can also follow him on social media. Speaking of which, you can follow me at Matt Pelser Radio, you know, if you want. I follow a lot of cavers, and so caving is all over my feed, which is great. If you're a caver, I'll follow you back. All right, I think that's it. Is that it? Pretty sure that's it. All right, until next time, kill nothing but time.